at some point in time. We want to be the intelligent person that everyone comes to, or the expert. It doesn't really matter, is what I've learned over the years. It's the ability to influence people, to work with people, to make people better, for example. That matters a ton more than being right about everything and being the smartest guy. You'll always be learning, improving. You'll always be flawed. It's fine. We'll never be perfect. It's fine. We have to, in some ways, at some point, share some of our imperfections as well.
Hello and welcome. I'm your host, Pritesh Sanyal, and you're listening to the 1% Project, conversations that will help you understand how some of the smartest minds build, scale, and operate new ideas and ventures. If you enjoy these conversations, do share and subscribe. Welcome to the second part of our captivating series with the remarkable Nuno Gonzalez Pedro. In this episode of the 1% Project, we continue our deep dive with Nuno about carving a unique path in the venture capital landscape. In the second episode of the two-part series, he shares his insights and perspectives on building a venture capital fund, investing in startups, shedding light on his decision-making strategies, and the meticulous analysis behind his investment decisions. As we delve further into this conversation, Nuno talks about his favorite books, productivity tools, and the mechanism he employs to analyze his decisions. Subscribe to the show wherever you're listening to it, and sign up to the 1% Project's Think newsletter at 1%.live for curated content that adds value to your professional and personal development. Stay till the end, where I summarize the key takeaways from this conversation with Nuno. We continue the discussion with Nuno, asking him about how he thinks about building Chameleon, his second venture capital fund, and the decision framework they use in investing in startups.
Venture capital as an asset class has seen a lot of innovation over the years in terms of branding, in terms of, you know, it was an industry that was very opaque, very stealthy. Brands were known by those that knew, but there wasn't a lot of marketing. Then you started getting a lot of marketing. So that was a big shift in playbook. And I'm not even going back to public-private partnerships, post-war, where the term carried interest actually comes from, which is from carried interest. So ships, and the owners of ships and those that were on ships that took a part of profits with carry, right? So it was the things that they were carrying they would take. So that's where carried interest comes from. The big shift into terms of brand building that guys like Andreessen Horowitz or firms like Andreessen Horowitz, Upfront, mostly Mark Sister and a few others have done, I think are clearly changes in shifts in playbook. We've seen a lot of shifts in playbook as a lot of these firms started building a lot of assets under management in terms of shared services, value proposition, and help that they can give to their portfolio companies in a very institutionalized manner. Some firms have over 100 people that are mostly doing shared services, that are doing market development, talent acquisition, helping companies do a variety of things like selling, hire, et cetera. But if you think about it, venture capital, really the value creation part of the equation is around the picking. It's around the point of deal sourcing, due diligence, and deal making, getting in the deal. I don't think many people would argue with me that most of the value is created there, because the difference between a 0x or a 1x and a 100x is very clearly there. It's about choosing the right company, the right team in the right market, and just sort of riding it effectively. I mean, you can get some value for the company, but it's really right. What I cannot be convinced is that most of the value is created after investment. A VC firm can create a couple of points of value for the company, facilitating an exit, creating an opportunity for the company to go to the next route, helping the company restructure itself, giving the company capital to restructure itself, might be the difference between a 1x and a 3x or a 2x and a 5x. But it's not going to be a difference between 1x and 100x, just to be clear. I know some VCs have done some incubation in-house and done whatever, but like VCs, strictly speaking, will not create that value post-investment. But that's where all the resources are going. And there's actually been very little innovation in picking. If you think about it, most of us, 95%, 99% probably even, invest in technology. Yet, we rarely use technology. I mean, we'll say we have these data sources and we have CRMs and all this stuff. We don't do any technology in-house. And the reason for that, in my opinion, is because most VC firms have very few people. In the Bay Area, this is an old stat, I think it's probably higher now. 95% of all VC firms in the Bay Area had less than 10 people. This was a 2018 number. So we have very limited people, and therefore we don't have technology. We have deal teams, and we do the same stuff. We hustle, we do podcasts, we do thought leadership, we speak at the universities, we go into our networks, we get scouts, we do all of this stuff. But why don't we use technology? Because it's difficult to use technology in early stage venture capital generally and in venture capital overall, because the data is very noisy. But because it's difficult doesn't mean it's impossible. Because it's difficult doesn't mean that it doesn't create a lot of value. And so that's what we do at Chameleon. We have a quantum tech team, quant from quantitative, not quantum, and technology team in-house that is larger than our deal team. And I'm very lucky and blessed to actually product manage them and product manage what we do. So to be really the bridge between the deal team and the quantum tech team to make sure that we have a bunch of stuff around deal sourcing, due diligence, and portfolio management that not only makes us be more fact-based, makes our networks be truly proprietary, the companies we're reaching out to is truly proprietary network, more than any other proprietary network could see, make us be as unbiased as we can, and makes us be fast and productive, which gains us great, great, unique advantages over the market for obvious reasons, timing reasons, et cetera. We have automations as well, which we use. So we use technology. I mean, to the point where now people are like, well, maybe you should actually use part of your technology and spin it off at some point and do SaaS play out. Yeah, cool. We'll get to there at some point, which is like, in the first instance, we use technology to make our lives easier, more productive, to have really generally proprietary data. And then when we have all of this with specific views on that, obviously not raw data, but specific views on this, we can anonymize data. We can share it with our portfolio companies. We can share it with our LPs. And we can then share it with something else, which we think is very unique about us, which is something we call #Kin, which is our people augmentation layer. So quantum tech augmentation, people augmentation. And augmentation is a network of incredible people, scouts, advisors, operators, ex-CEOs of anything you can imagine that really spend time with us, spend time with our portfolio company, spend time with our LPs. We're really not gatekeepers. We're just the guys who just facilitate an ecosystem that builds around us. Because at the end of the day, our job is to create value for our investors. That's what we do as a venture capital firm. And the more we make this ecosystem bloom, our view is the better the value is that we're creating through our fund. That's as simple as that. So that's the part on the people augmentation side. So these two are things are very contrary. I have had arguments with VCs, but this is the future. This has to happen. This asset class needs to use more technology. There's no other way.
You focus on consumer tech. Do you see there is enough space or has consumer tech potentially hit a glass ceiling and a revolutionary technology or some kind of evolution, maybe like ChatGPT, has to happen?
Oh, there's so much space to invest in. At a very macro level, we are seeing two fundamental shifts on demographics. One is Gen Z, very different from millennials. And that by itself will create the need for services that clearly are not there yet or don't exist in some cases. We're talking about massive industries that are up for grabs or at least some level of disruption. I'm not saying, you know, Facebook's going to die or Instagram's going to die or whatever. And we saw it with TikTok. TikTok from nowhere to being the social thing. So clearly there is a taxonomic shift that we're going to observe with Gen Zers pulling the strings and understanding those latent use cases and how they might be better served and best served is a whole thing that we're spending quite a lot of time on right now as a firm. We are also very interested in the other demographic shift that is really interesting to us, which is that of seniors. We're having a very digitally educated senior demographic that is emerging, sort of 65 and older, which is new in most countries for sure. And that changes the whole paradigm of how do you serve seniors, because it always used to be that the customer, the person who paid for the service, who set it up maybe, et cetera, wasn't the user. So the elderly person was the user, but their children were in many cases the customer, whatever. This doesn't work. People didn't want to use certain services, whatever. It's going to disappear. I think it will also create the need for services that don't exist necessarily. So I'm very bullish on consumers. So that's the macro vision. The micro vision is much simpler. There's always major innovation in consumer. I mean, it's like, when was the last time that we didn't see a big shift in consumer over periods of 3 or 4 years? Never, since I was alive. I remember when we were talking about Fortnite, it was like, oh my God, and Epic, and Where did these guys come from? Obviously, they've been around for a while. We were talking about Snapchat, and Snapchat had conquered the world. And then so maybe it's not just Snapchat. There's other things happening. And then it was TikTok and musically TikTok. So we're always seeing this shift because people do want to use different tools. And to your point, I do think AI into the consumer realm is something we've been talking for at least a decade and a half. And it's now coming really to fruition.
You're right. AI has been around for some time. But ChatGPT has probably made AI consumer grade. It is actually coming to the end consumer in a much more natural and an obvious way rather than AI working in the background and people just making memes out of them.
I mean, I agree. It's a game shifter. I think we're still to see a lot more cool stuff coming out. And there's going to be a real AI war, which is cool as well. And I think there will be a lot of value to all of us. Consumers are not just consumers. So yeah, it's a fundamental shift. I don't disagree, but I feel there's a lot more stuff happening and all this stuff now saying Google and the Google's done. I'm like, yeah, not really. Because if you are hard pressed to say who has some of the best talent in the world in all areas of artificial intelligence, you would probably say Google. And so I can't really believe that they are sort of out of the game and everyone else is in the game. There is a war happening, clearly. I feel the war's been panning out for the last decade or so. I feel we're just sort of at the beginning of that, of taking that first layer of the onion. So we're not there yet. We don't even understand what's going to happen. And we don't understand the implications either, which is a bit scary. Someone was posting about these conversations that they were having with Bing Search and whatever not on the Bing engine falling in love with them and saying better than your wife type thing. So maybe we'll have her, the movie, sooner rather than later in real life. But anyway, we'll see.
Venture capital has a lot of noise, but you need to do a lot of research as well. And you have to take a number of key decisions. So two aspects of that. One, how do you arrange facts? And second is, how do you study your own decisions? What is the mechanism of analyzing your decision framework?
So the first question, there's always been, right, two extreme schools of thought in venture capital. One was probably best edified by Excel. In the good old days, Excel is doing very well right now, just to be clear, meaning a couple of decades ago, which was a prepared mind logic of the world. Market scanning, top-down assessments of markets. Where are there areas that don't quite work? And how should we invest in that, right? What sort of place would we invest in if we saw them? So very prepared mind, top-down. And then there was the other sort of view of the world, which is sort of the benchmark view of the world, which is startups are complex systems. They obviously act within markets that need to be assessed and evaluated, but they're very complex systems. And therefore, because they're very complex systems, they should be best assessed bottom up. I would say we as Camille are probably a little bit closer to the benchmark school of thought, but we don't get away with not doing the market scans and the market assessments and the top-down thing. So we do both. And so we come to our realization on a specific sub-industry by two ways. One is the top-down way. A market scan might be latent demand research, ethnographic studies, something that we do in partnership with someone else. It comes from our engine because we have a lot of data that comes from our engine that is top-down assessment. And that educates us on that space or in that subspace. The bottom-up analysis also informs us. When we look at a startup, we don't only look at a startup. We look at their industry. We look at their competitors. Again, we have a lot of quantum tech data on the company and their competitors. Again, we have a lot of very specific micro data on them, retention engagement data, if it's a SaaS company, anything on their metrics or core metrics. And so we look a lot at that. And in some cases, these worlds collide, which is, okay, we start doing a bottom-up assessment on a company. And something magic, by the way, happens. I don't know. I don't think it's our engine for sure, but something magic happens. And it's happened to me in venture capital for the last 12 years. I've been doing this for 12 years. So almost 13 now. Which is when you're talking to a company in a specific space, the odds that you're going to talk to two or three more companies in that specific space within a space of a couple of weeks is very high. It's like magic. It's like you're talking to one company and all of a sudden you're seeing two or three in the same space or around the same space or adjacency. And so that allows you to actually at some point say, you know what, we should understand this market better. So we're doing bottom-up assessments, three or four companies, but should look at the market top-down. And let's do that exercise. Any case, the decision will be made on the company, but we will spend a lot of time on market assessment. I'm a relatively positive person, but there's one pet peeve that I have with early stage VC in general. There's this systemic sort of message being passed to the market that in early stage, we invest based on the team and the people and whatever. It's like, of course we do, but that shouldn't be it. It's very obvious if you think about it, but most people, for some reason, either don't do it or they don't talk about doing it. In many cases, the former rather than the latter, which is, for example, market assessment. Even if you're talking to a company, let's say pre-seed or even seed, and it's pre-launch, okay, they might have a beta trial. Why wouldn't you look at their beta trial information? It's like, oh, but it's not representative. Why isn't it representative? The retention engagement numbers could be actually interesting to look at. Even if they don't have much traction, it's private or whatever, it's fine. Why wouldn't you look at the market? This is my biggest pet peeve, market. Oh, no, that's not worthwhile. Not worthwhile? Why? Do you know entrepreneurs that, even if great entrepreneurs that win against crappy markets? I don't. I know great entrepreneurs that go against crappy markets, that pivot like hell and end up with amazing companies. I don't know any great entrepreneurs that go against bad markets that win. That I don't know. Market assessment is a basic thing. It's like, if you don't understand the market, if you don't have an understanding of the competition landscape beyond just the entrepreneur and the company you're talking to, if this is a really large market, like basic stuff, TAM, SOM, right? So total addressable market, serviceable addressable market, share of market. If you don't have a clue of those numbers at all directionally, and this is directionally, you will never know the exact numbers or be able to estimate them. But if you as a VC firm don't have that, how can you invest? You don't have a clue if it's a good market or not. And we've seen this over and over again, because then VCs become lemmings. Everyone goes into that space. Okay, there's someone investing in that space. We're all going to invest in that space. And at some point, someone's like, why did everyone invest in that space? Oh, that other guys that started it. And if you go back to the origin sometimes of the decision, it sometimes had nothing to do with the market or with the trend. It had to do with they love the company and they invest in that company. That was cool. And then all the other people that came is like, oh, there's a market trend. So again, market assessments is my pet peeve. I don't know why people don't do it seriously. We feel there should be a lot more of it done, even with limited resources. It's that little part of going the extra mile on due diligence, going the extra mile on analysis.
And what about decision-making?
Decision-making is sort of one of the single most important things in venture capital. How do you make decisions? And it is actually probably the most nuanced piece of our own venture capital that people don't really understand. Everyone thinks about VCs as, oh, they have knowledge or they have experience and expertise or they can bring value to the table or all of that stuff. But if the VC firm for a specific fund can't make good decisions in a good way, that is problematic. So there's a couple of angles to it. There's the actual investment committee, the structure under which the decision on a specific investment is made. How does that work? Is it majority led? Is it by unanimity? Do you allow any partner to make an investment at a certain level? How do you structure that? And there has to be a lot of thinking around that. And that thinking needs to include the partners in the sense that you need to understand the different partners you have at the table and how they interact into that. That can create or destroy a lot of value because the key decisions around investing and liquidation of the company are all there. They're all in the investment committee, right? So how that operates, how the dynamics of that group operates, do they meet every week? They meet every month? Is that a flow through from the partner meeting? How do the partner meetings then operate is the second thing. Partner meetings are normally weekly, depends on the firm. How do you run them? How do you listen to your associates? How do you make decisions to move a deal forward or not? Simple things. You're like, oh, that's simple. No, it's not simple at all. What's your skew? Is it skewed towards negativity? You kill all the deals? Is there a louder voice in the room? Is there a partner or managing partner that has a louder voice than everyone else that kills everything and only approves the stuff that he or she likes? How do you unbias that is really critical. How do you evaluate those decisions through time? Do you go back to them? Do you go back to, okay, we missed that one. We shouldn't invest in them. Or we invest in this company. It was crap. Why did we invest in them? What were the mistakes that we made? Or invest in this company, they were great. I actually find this last case is actually some of the most telling cases and probably where there's least insight. Like the insight is actually very deep. If you go back and you really went deep dive into a postmortem or the analysis of how that decision was made in the firm, you would uncover much more interesting and salient points of how the decision was made. And the salient points were around dynamics, for example, dynamics between partners, what one partner was pushing or an associate, how do they push it? So we spend a lot of time on that. We describe everything, we log everything. Our investment memos are very thorough, not only in terms of analysis, but also in terms of decisions and who's voting for what and the assessment of each of the partners on specific areas of the deal, not just the deal itself. We revisit them over time. We've done it in previous funds. And that revisiting piece is a piece, again, that is complex. It's okay, you bring it to the table and who facilitates the process? Who has the discussion on the postmortem? Who comes back? It's all about not being personal. It's all about, okay, this is what happened. This is how we processed it. What are the nuggets here? What we would have done differently? And these feedback loops that we hit on should be regular. They should be part of our instinctual ability to look at it. And in some ways, we revert them back to our quantitative and technology engine. That then becomes requirements. That then becomes like, okay, we saw biases on this stuff. Or we looked at this deal. We had the first call with this company. It was crap. And these are the reasons why they were crap. That is something that we do on a weekly basis. So that's like even more systemic than anything on decision-making. You have to reevaluate your process to be good at this thing all the time. And there can be no ego. I mean, we all have egos. Unfortunately, I have a very big ego. My partners do have hopefully smaller egos than me, but we have to take our ego and leave it there and go and have the discussion.
Some quick questions. 3 productivity tools.
I use our engine all the time. So that's one of our actually competitive things. So that's clearly my number one productivity tool. Going to stuff that people can just get out of the market. I would say Superhuman. I was against it for a long time. I didn't see the point in it for a long time. It's overpriced still. I hope the founder listens to this. Still, it's overpriced and it's only on iOS and mobile, which just pisses me off. But I have to say, I use it and changed the way I do emails. And I was very disciplined at emailing, but it just changed the way I do emails. And email still for me is a huge piece of what I do. A third productivity tool, I'm a ridiculous calendarer. So I put everything on my calendar.
3 books that you would recommend to anyone and everyone?
I would say From Good to Great was a book that changed me a lot. It's more of a big corporation book, relatively serious analysis from what we can tell that Jim did on what makes good companies over time become great, which is very difficult, in particular for larger companies. So the elephants that are made to dance, in effect. I've made a few in my career. I'm very lucky. But that book is exceptional. The chapter on leadership alone, you should just read it. Maybe second book, The Lean Startup is a must read book. I don't agree with everything that Eric writes. I've met him a couple of times. The book is a very good way of describing what makes a startup be a startup in today's world where, you know, cost base has come down, where you need to be more iterative, where you not need to try hitting different product market fits, et cetera, et cetera. The Hard Thing About Hard Things, Ben Horowitz, it's a wonderful book about entrepreneurship where you get the pain of being an entrepreneur really well. I think we've had a fad in entrepreneurship where there's a lot of tourist entrepreneurs now, people that maybe are doing it for the wrong reasons because they think it's cool and they can be in magazines and stuff. You know, it's probably a very small portion of entrepreneurship, but it still exists. That book sort of explains really well why that's not at all the case. On the fictional side, one that keeps coming back to my mind and I need to reread it is Ben Okri's Astonishing the Gods, which won the Booker Prize many moons back. And it's a book that I just love. The God of Small Things, Arundhati Roy. There's a couple of books in fiction. In some ways, I like nonfiction stuff. And there's a lot of stuff that I've read over the years that changed my life or how I looked at things. From Clouds to Code was an old book that I read in college that changed my view on engineering and how engineering teams should work. So there's a lot of really cool stuff out there.
Before we close, what advice will you give to your younger self?
One, to enjoy life more. In some ways, I've always been very driven and I've had my ups and downs with my religion and my spirituality, which I now feel is getting better with age. I probably would have done more of that. So that would be my second lesson learned. Spend more time with, in my case, as I said, I'm Catholic. So I'll put in the pitch, spend more time with God and praying. Thirdly, don't sweat the small stuff. Let stuff go. I believe I've gotten much better with age. I would fight a lot of battles when I was younger that honestly didn't really make a huge difference. And in some ways, they were driven by pride. They're driven by, okay, I need to be the smartest guy in the room. I think the final thing I would say is almost anyone that goes into sort of business wants to be the smartest guy or gal in the room at some point in time. We want to be the intelligent person that everyone comes to or the expert. It doesn't really matter, is what I've learned over the years. It's the ability to influence people, to work with people, to make people better, for example, that matters a ton more than being right about everything and being the smartest guy in the room. With age, I more and more want to be in rooms where I'm definitely not the smartest guy in the room. And I'm there to listen, which I'm still working on. You'll always be learning, improving. You'll always be flawed. It's fine. We'll never be perfect. It's fine. We have to, in some ways, at some point, share some of our imperfections as well. I've learned over the years that some of my imperfections have become things that are very distinctive about me, that people actually like about me, are my imperfections.
Brilliant, Nuno. That's a great place to close this conversation. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Nuno. Here are the key takeaways. Number one, in venture capital, while many resources and efforts are focused on post-investment value creation, the true value of venture capital lies in the initial stages of identifying and choosing the right companies, teams, and markets. Number two, the way decisions are made and the structure of discussions can significantly impact the quality of investments. It is important to carefully consider factors such as decision-making process, voting mechanisms, biases, and the inclusion of diverse perspectives within the decision-making forums. And number three, it is okay to be imperfect. Imperfections can be distinctive and even appreciated by others. It reminds us to prioritize personal growth, cultivate humility, and build meaningful relationships to sail through life. If you enjoyed this episode, share it with someone who will find it valuable. For any recommendations and feedback, you can drop me a line at pritish@1%.live. It is pritish@onepercent.live. Until next time.